This is a beautiful word we can't hear often enough.
We have a cure.
And now we have new options where we can say, yeah,
you're cured.
But this cure has a price, a big one. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
If we find them, we probably have a good idea that an area is healthy.
That's the bean screaming for its life.
Basically, you're allowing air to bubble through.
There are things that you do that influence your friends' friends.
You can't have people making claims and selling tests that have not proven they work yet.
2 to 3 million people in the United States know that they're getting
what I've lost.
Itchy eyes, sneezing.
Well, when upwelling happens, it's when you have these really
different shakers out of
yes, she can go home.
Everything should be patient-centric.
On today's show, living with too much iron in your blood, the impact of lead on behavior, and flying dinosaurs. But first, back to that beautiful word, cure. Not a word the medical community uses lightly, but we have heard it quite a bit lately in connection with a new line of treatments for hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a serious liver disease. Between 3 to 4 million Americans are chronically infected. Many of them don't know they have it, and the rates are higher among the baby boomers. It can be transmitted through drug injection, sex, or via blood transfusions that took place before 1992. So this new drug is a really big deal. But the gigantic price tag attached to it is raising questions about the cost of care. Alana Gordon reports.
Paul Yeaber, a community activist, learned he had hepatitis C before it even had a name.
I was diagnosed with hepatitis non-A, non-B in 1990 as a result of a follow-up to a diagnosis of HIV and AIDS.
Hepatitis C didn't really surface in the medical community until the 90s. But it's the most common bloodborne disease in the U.S. For those who are chronically infected, complications may not surface for years or even decades. But over time, the virus eats away at the liver and may lead to severe scarring, liver disease, or cancer.
And I've seen people die, people I admire, people who were doing things with their life. And I've also seen the disastrous effects of long-term liver disease. It's a horrible way to die. And I wouldn't wish it on anyone.
The main treatment for hepatitis C has long involved a daily injection of a substance called interferon to be taken for about 6 months. People liken its side effects to chemo, intense fatigue, fevers, suicidal thoughts. On top of that, there's no guarantee it will clear the virus. Chances of cure range from 60 to now 80%. On the flip side, those who develop advanced liver disease may need a transplant. Yeaber, with his doctor, had ultimately decided to monitor his virus and postpone treatment, with the hopes that something better would come along. It's a strategy some in medicine refer to as warehousing, but
there was always a tape running in the background that said, you know, you're running out of time. You know what this thing's going to do to you.
Yeaber, who's 52 years old now, may soon get to hit stop on that tape. That's in part thanks to a Bucks County scientist, Mike Sophia, and more specifically to a new hepatitis C drug he co-invented called sofosbuvir.
It hit me because we were just, you know, drawing chemical structures on a piece of paper, and I looked at this one structure and I said, you know, this is the direction.
Sophia has spent the last few years zeroing in on the hepatitis C virus at a small biotech company, Pharmacet, in Princeton, New Jersey. He says one challenge that has stumped scientists for decades is how to formulate a drug so it only targets the liver without negatively affecting other parts of the body. His lab essentially figured out how to mask the drug when it's ingested and program it to only go to the liver.
And then once that drug gets to where you want it to go, this mask that's on this drug is now able to fall off because you take advantage of some property within that cell or within that organ that allows that to happen.
So once in the liver, the drug stays there and attacks the virus. This is a concept that a wave of new hepatitis C drugs still in the development pipeline are incorporating. Sophia says the introduction of sofosbuvir in December has meant that for the very first time, hepatitis C has an interferon-free treatment option. It still has to be taken with other drugs, and some strains respond better than others. But so far, it boasts fewer side effects, only needs to be taken for 3 months, and has shown cure rates surpassing 90% in phase 3 clinical trials.
That set the HCV world on fire.
what we have on our hands is possibly the greatest accomplishment, public health accomplishment of our generation with the new treatments of hepatitis C.
Dr. Stacy Truskin oversees care for several hundred hepatitis C patients at Drexel's partnership clinic.
Yeah, I think cure is our new favorite word. We don't get to say it very often.
Truskin says the development has spurred increased testing efforts. A lot of people don't know they're infected. The industry saw the drug's potential, too. Before it gained FDA approval, the drug company Gilead bought Pharmasset, a company of less than 100 people, for $11 billion. The move set in motion what some describe as one of the most successful drug launches in U.S. history. For Paul Yaber, it set in motion the start of treatment he'd been holding out for years.
Hi, Don Paul. How are you?
Okay. How are you, Anelta?
All right. So this is actually your four-week follow-up.
Mm-hmm. On a recent morning, Yaber takes a seat in the office of Lynelta Nobles, a pharmacist at the Jonathan Lacks Treatment Center in Philadelphia. They've known each other for a long time. Nobles reviews Yaber's labs and says she's seeing signs of success already.
But do you remember what you were before you started treatment?
No, I didn't.
At 3 million copies.
Okay.
Okay, so after 2 weeks of treatment, you actually went all the way down to less than 15 copies.
Wow. So that's fantastic.
Nobles tells Yaber adherence is critical in order for the drug to work, and also because it's not cheap. She hands him a pill box containing his next month's supply of sofosbuvir, along with other drugs.
So, Paul, just so you know, just in hepatitis C medications, this is worth $60,000.
Wow.
At its retail price, the new drug is about $1,000 a pill, commonly taken once a day for 3 months in combination with another costly drug. Insurers, Medicaid agencies have been questioning the price. And some Senate leaders recently called for a congressional investigation. On the ground, many patients report having a hard time getting approved for coverage of the drug. Yaber was denied at first. Kenneth George is a pharmacist back at Drexel's partnership clinic.
I don't want to make the patient feel like they don't deserve to be treated with expensive medication. But I do warn the patient, it is very likely that we are going to get denied.
George says from there he appeals, often with success, but not always. He also says treatment guidelines and eligibility criteria are constantly changing right now, complicating matters more. Pennsylvania's Medicaid agency requires that patients show signs of liver disease to qualify for the new treatment. Again, Dr. Stacy Truskin.
This is really a sign of the times, and there needs to be conversations that happen between the payers and the insurance companies. So as providers, we can do what we love to do, and that's to take care of the patient and give them, you know, the treatment that so many of us have been waiting so long to give them.
Whenever a product comes out and it has a very expensive price tag, it raises eyebrows.
Eric Koifel is professor of health economics at Temple University. He says Gilead is in the sweet spot right now, having earned $2 to $3 billion in sales of the drug in the first quarter alone. But drug pricing in the U.S. is based on free market principles.
So generally in this country, we pay higher prices than in other countries. We also have larger incomes than in other countries. But we also, you know, don't use all the tools necessarily we could if we really wanted to negotiate down prices. Part of the reason for that, I think, is that we value innovation here.
He says companies have more leverage to set prices if they're first to develop and patent a drug. But that encourages them to take risks, to develop a product over years that may very likely fail and not get approved. Other specialty cancer drugs already cost 2, 3, 4 times more than sofosbuvir. But Koifel says the challenge with this new hepatitis C drug is that millions of people could potentially benefit from it.
So it's cost effective, but there's so many people. And the question then becomes, how are we going to pay for all that?
The drug company Gilead defends the price. It points to the long-term benefits of a short-term treatment. It's a one-time regimen that can rid a person of hepatitis C without the need for a costly liver transplant down the road. The company also stresses that existing treatments are already expensive. Koifel thinks once a new wave of drugs makes it through the pipeline, and that is expected soon, the price of sofosbuvir may go down. At the end of his visit with the pharmacist, Paul Yaber places that next round of expensive medicine in his backpack and heads out the door.
Thank you.
Yeber says for him, waiting all those years for the new medicine has finally paid off.
I'm now going to be living a life without the threat of death by hepatitis C.
Are you laughing because it's kind of funny to say that, like in this context, or what's going through your mind?
I'm laughing because I'm happy. I'm laughing out of joy. You know, it's like this has been a long battle.
Yeber says just the act of taking the drug has already had a positive impact. He feels younger.
You know, I get up in the morning and I kind of, you know, like everyone else, you drag yourself through the morning, you do your routine or whatever that might be. And I just kind of felt like somebody put a bigger battery in me. There was a little more pep in my step.
Yeber has 4 weeks left of treatment before he's hoping he'll be totally free of hepatitis C. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and now it's time for a science news update. Joining us is regular Pulse contributor Carrie Grenz. She's an associate editor for The Scientist, and in that role, she reads through lots and lots of studies every week and keeps us posted on the latest. Her picks for this week are flying dinosaurs, genetic pacemakers, and lab safety. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Mike.
Carrie, let's start with the flying dinos.
Yes. For a long time, it's been thought that dinosaurs didn't fly. Even though it's widely believed that birds descended from dinosaurs, flight is thought to be an invention that birds came up with. This week, scientists reported that a new dinosaur species identified from a fossil in China was completely covered in feathers. Now, this is not the first feathered dinosaur to be dug up, but it's definitely the largest. It was 4 feet long, and it had big teeth and sharp claws. So one of the big questions about this animal now is whether it actually flew like a bird. It's possible that it just glided more like a flying squirrel.
Or maybe it just had feathers.
Right, or maybe it just had feathers. That's entirely possible.
So the other kind of flying creatures that my kids have in various gummy forms are not dinosaurs, like the pteranodons?
Right, those were not dinosaurs. They lived at the time of the dinosaurs, but they are a different branch.
What does this new finding of this potentially flying dinosaur mean?
Well, they think it might represent the earlier part of the evolution of flight, you know, that perhaps it wasn't an invention of the birds, but came earlier. And it might help understand how flight came to be, you know, what was required of the body plan design and the feathers and the bones and things like that to enable animals to take flight.
Carrie, let's move on to our second topic, genetic pacemakers. What is that?
So instead of an electronic pacemaker that you would have implanted into your heart, what scientists are reporting this week that they have done is they've developed a cellular pacemaker. They've made the body, or at least the body of a pig, make its own pacemaker cells. So our hearts already have their own pacemaker cells, but for some people who have slow cardiac rhythms, they benefit from an implanted pacemaker to keep it at the right pace. So this latest study that came out this week, researchers injected pig hearts with a gene that converts their heart muscle cells into these pacemaker cells. These pigs all had a heart condition, and the scientists found that these pacemaker cells did their job. They kept the heart rate up, and these pigs were less dependent on a pacemaker implant.
What's the potential of this? Could be pretty big.
Absolutely. I think what the researchers originally thought was that this could perhaps be a bridge therapy for people who have to have their pacemaker removed. Say if they got an infection, you might have to take it out for a couple weeks, let the tissue heal, take some antibiotics, and that maybe you could have this gene therapy work. Because in this case, the experiment was just 2 weeks long. So this isn't thought that it's necessarily a permanent treatment, but perhaps it could be just a temporary bridge while you're having the pacemaker removed.
Carrie, we also want to talk to you today about hazardous biomaterial transfers. We've heard a lot of kind of scary news about that.
Right. There have been a number of news reports coming out in recent days and weeks. So some of the big news that broke last week is that smallpox vials dating back to the 1950s were found in a storage closet in a lab at the FDA. Nobody knows what they were doing there. And, you know, it's disturbing that there was no knowledge of their presence. Then the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported last Friday that a dangerous strain of bird flu was accidentally shipped to the USDA. All of this comes on the heels of an anthrax snafu back in June, where dozens of government workers could have been exposed. So the picture that's beginning to emerge now is that there seems to be a kind of culture of lax biosecurity, maybe not in every lab at the CDC, but enough to cause these multiple incidents. So this week, a House committee released a report from the USDA that looked at some of the problems at the CDC and found that the CDC was storing anthrax in unlocked refrigerators with no signs on them. People were shipping things in Ziploc bags. Disinfectants had expired. So now the attention is turning to, you know, how did this happen and how can we clean up these labs that handle dangerous materials?
What kind of security measures are typically in place with a lab that handles potentially dangerous materials?
There are different levels of biosecurity. So at the strictest, you might have a secured facility that's locked that only certain personnel have clearance to enter. They may have to don a Tyvek jumpsuit and shower upon leaving. I think that the reason why there's so much attention on the CDC is that it handles these very, very dangerous materials. Smallpox, for instance, the World Health Organization only sanctions two places in the world to store smallpox, one of which is the CDC. So they're handling things that are potentially much more dangerous than your run-of-the-mill, you know, infectious disease lab. And there's kind of, you know, sort of a flurry of activity, especially at the CDC now. The agency put a moratorium on shipping biological materials from its topmost biosecurity facilities. So they're taking some security precautions right now to figure out where these weaknesses are in the safety protocols.
Kerry Grenz, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Megan.
Kerry Grenz is an associate editor with The Scientist, and she joins us regularly on The Pulse to keep us updated on the latest science news. Coming up on The Pulse, we go to the gym to try a new approach to muscle building.
We'll take the chest press. Come on, do one more.
Oh.
Don't bounce it.
Well, sort of. You're listening to The Pulse here on WHYY.
Send a message to God in heaven.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Dropping 20-plus pounds quickly is an all-American pursuit, and there's always a brand new IT fitness method to help us do just that. Sean T's Focus 25, Beachbody, Bootcamp, Metamorphosis, I mean, even Pilates was the hot new thing at some point.
Mainline Fitness Gym in Haverford, Pennsylvania is all about an approach called X-Force or Negative Force. General Manager Mary Hackett gave me a tour of their space-age-looking workout room.
This is the X-Force room. This is where we house all of our X-Force equipment. The difference being the negative aspect of the training. So you can see when Jane is training her client, there's a canister next to her that houses the weight stack. On the negative phase of the workout, the lowering part of the exercise, the canister is going to flip and put 40% more weight onto her to lower down.
And that extra resistance fatigues the muscle about 50% faster than you could do with a standard barbell or exercise machine.
That's the king of negative force. He looks like a drill sergeant, and he's 70.
I'm Ellington Darden. I have a PhD in exercise science, and I've written The Body Fat Breakthrough.
I'm in need of a breakthrough, so I asked Darden to show me how the machines work.
We'll take the chest press.
Chest press? Over.
Yeah, come on over here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, as soon as you get back, let it touch and then start another. Now I want you to do about five more.
Oh, my goodness. So you're getting crushed. Gently.
Well, see, those muscles are contracting, and now they're uncontracting. So you got to uncontract and tear those fibers across your chest just a little bit, and that's what causes the soreness, and that's what causes the stimulation for the muscle to get bigger and stronger, see?
Okay.
And this does it. All right, do one more. Come on, do one more.
Oh!
Don't bounce it. All right, now that's good. You've done a good job.
The negative force machines are not widely available, so Ellington Darden developed an at-home version of this kind of exercise. He calls it 30-30-30.
A 30-second lowering followed by a 30-second raising followed by another 30-second lowering. So it's 1.5 repetitions that you can do with your own body weight or with a barbell or almost any exercise machine.
Give me an example of something I could do at home.
Well, you know how to do a deep knee bend. You stand up and you bend your hips and knees and you go down and you sit on your heels and then you return to your top. Well, what I recommend you do is you stand next to the edge of a door, something to hold on to keep your balance. And then you lower yourself to a deep squat position in 30 seconds, come back to a standing position in 30 seconds, and then repeat the first 30 seconds. So you're doing 60 seconds of lowering and 30 seconds of raising. It's 1.5 repetitions in 90 seconds. Now that will thoroughly fatigue your hips and thighs. That's something you can do at home, and you'll feel it immediately.
Give me another example. Let's say like a plank or a push-up, that
All
kind
right.
of thing.
All right, let's take a push-up. Most people focus on pushing up. Well, what I'm telling you to do is focus on lowering yourself. You know, get in a push-up position on your hands with your elbows straight and on your toes, and instead of dropping down quickly, see if you can go down, if you're a woman, in 30 seconds. All the way down, let your chest touch. If you're a man, try to go down in 60 seconds. Don't worry about doing 10 repetitions. Worry about trying to lower yourself in 30 to 60 seconds. Now, that'll work the muscles more than doing 10 or 20 push-ups fast.
When you started doing this form of exercise, what did you see? What did you notice with yourself?
That it makes you very tired. Makes you very sleepy, and you're very hungry. And if you reduce your dietary calories when you do 6 or 8 of these different exercises in this form, your body pulls calories from your fat cells to build muscle. So it's an excellent way to combine the process of muscle building and fat loss together.
It sounds too good to be true, almost.
It's not too good to be true. But I thought you were going to say it doesn't sound easy. It's not easy. It's a very difficult, demanding situation. But it doesn't take very long.
You're doing this, obviously. So how do you feel?
I feel bigger and stronger when I do it.
You can't touch this. Dr. Ellington Darden is a fitness expert, and he has written several books. His latest is The Body Fat Breakthrough.
I've been trying this 30-30-30 thing at my gym, by the way. It's kind of like Tai Chi weightlifting, really slowly, and it does make you very sore. If I lose 30 pounds, you'll be the first to know. You're listening to The Pulse.
Can't touch this. Yeah, that's how we living, and you know you can't touch this. Look at my eyes, man. You can't touch this. Yo, let me bust the funky lyrics.
Humans need iron to carry oxygen throughout the body in red blood cells, but too much iron can be toxic. For this edition of our series Patient Files, we went to Jefferson Hospital's Blood Donor Center to learn more about one of the most common genetic disorders, one you probably have never heard of.
I'm Craig Hooper, a professor at Thomas Jefferson University, and I've been recently diagnosed with hereditary hemochromatosis. If it's not diagnosed, you usually show up with congestive heart failure, cirrhosis, type 2 diabetes.
Hemochromatosis is the inability to metabolize the ferritin properly. Whereas your body takes the ferritin and it breaks it down, it all gets through the liver, your old red cells, everything gets expelled. His kind of just go, hmm. My name is Lori Summers. I'm one of the charge nurses here at the Jefferson Blood Donor Center.
But 3 years ago, my liver enzymes were up a little bit in my annual physical. And my primary care physician wasn't too worried about it. This year, same thing again. We sent out a panel to look at hepatitis, and they look for different parameters, one of which is ferritin. Its sole purpose is to bind iron, and my ferritin levels came back about 10 times normal. The treatment for this high ferritin level is very simple, and that's to take a unit of blood from you once a week until you can drain the iron down to normal.
So I prepped his arm, let it dry, and then I used a 16-gauge needle and went in 45 degrees and...
Physiologically, it's hard on your system to get bled on a weekly basis. It changes your blood pressure a lot. And there are times when you really absolutely run out of energy in a way that you're not used to. It's like a battery running out.
So I'll have you squeeze that ball every couple seconds, and the goal is to get 485 mLs of whole blood into that bag.
It's been building up, you know, basically since I was born. More recently, I've had some other little problems that I thought was aging. And it's probably not. It's probably iron accumulation. What has surprised me is that many of my colleagues, clinical colleagues, have never heard of it, despite the fact that this gene mutation is quite common. This particular gene, the one that I have, is present in one copy in about one out of every 200 individuals who originated in northwestern Europe. Ireland, Scotland, England, France also. And in some areas in Ireland, it's one out of five people have the gene.
Okay, let me have you hold pressure and raise your arm straight up in the air.
What bothered me is that it's been very, very difficult to find foods that are actually low in iron. So the first thing you do is give up on red meat. You know, I was eating a type of cereal that had about 90% of the daily iron dose, and the daily iron dose on the packaging is based on what women need. They need about 18 milligrams, and men only need about 8.
50 years ago, people didn't go to the doctor, and they didn't draw these kinds of blood tests, and nobody ever knew, because it's very silent for the most part. You would never know you would have this, and over time, it just builds toxicity into your organs, because the ferritin has nowhere to go.
I would say by the third phlebotomy session, I started to actually feel better, feel different. So the downhill slide wasn't as noticeable as the turnaround. You know, I'm trying not to let this impact my daily life. And I think that's important with any kind of disorder.
Craig
Greg Hooper has hemochromatosis. It's a condition where too much iron builds up in his blood, and over 1 million people in the U.S. have this. Hooper has to continue the weekly bleedings for about a month or until his iron levels return to normal. We also heard from nurse Lori Sommers. Laura Benchoff produced this piece. Coming up on The Pulse, scouring the walls of Philadelphia houses for an old enemy.
Actually, we do have a problem there, if you notice.
And a vintage research study that laid the groundwork for prevention efforts.
What he did is he started this project called the Tooth Fairy Project.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott.
You're watching the most sensational achievement the decorating world has ever known. Now, for the first time, you can actually roll a new kind of beauty onto your walls. The effects can be subtle or bold, soft or shimmering.
Lead paint is a thing of the past, but the past continues to haunt cities like Philadelphia, where a lot of the housing stock is older. A new lead law came into effect in the city in 2012. It requires landlords to have older properties tested for lead paint before they can rent to families with small children. But kids are still being exposed. Reporter Audrey Quinn takes a look at the impact of lead, past and present, in the city.
Today, Aladdin Rathi is visiting a row home in northeast Philadelphia. It's a brick two-story unit with a white metal awning. He tries the doorknob. It opens. The place is empty inside. He steps into the living room. Mirrored wall, stubby beige carpeting, and like any Philadelphia housing built before 1978, this place likely contains lead paint. It has to get certified as safe if the landlord wants to rent to tenants with small kids. That's where Rathi comes in.
What we first do when we get to reach a particular unit, we check visually whether there is any paint which is chipping, which is flaking.
He heads upstairs.
Actually, we do have a problem there, if you notice.
The paint on the ceiling is starting to peel back.
Usually in houses, there is layers over layers of paint. The top layer could be fine, but in case it's chipping, it's uncovering a layer which is underneath, which could be actually containing lead, and that would be a disaster. I mean, just a little flake. A kid who is 3 years old would just, hey, play with it, put it in his mouth.
I'll admit, I'm kind of a skeptic when it comes to environmental hazards. Like, come on, a little bit of chemicals isn't going to hurt you. But lead paint, especially if you're still a developing kid, it's the real deal. Bad news.
Oh, boy. In the early part of the century, children literally convulsed.
That's David Rosner. He's a lead poisoning historian with Columbia University's School of Public Health.
The descriptions are horrifying. They became paralyzed, eyes going back in their head, dramatic neurological symptoms.
Lead paint was everywhere in the early 1900s. Kids were dying from it.
I mean, weren't people getting mad?
Well, people noticed it, and clinicians were noticing it. But, this industry was huge, and it was very powerful.
The lead paint industry was so huge and powerful, lead-based paint wasn't outlawed till 1978. People got more careful. You saw less kids having seizures over lead. But something more sinister was happening.
In Philadelphia, a pediatrician named Herb Needleman, he had his office across from a school, and the school was in a poor neighborhood, and the kids were doing badly.
This was the late 50s. Dr. Needleman had noticed before that his lead poison patients, they seemed to have some behavioral issues, more than seemed normal. He wondered if lead poisoning might have something to do with the problems at the school. But how could he prove that?
And lo and behold, what he did is he started this project called the Tooth Fairy Project.
The Tooth Fairy Project. Lead only stays around in kids' blood a little while. But baby teeth, it turns out they're a great place to look if you want to know about a kid's long-term lead exposure. Needleman measured lead levels in a bunch of kids' teeth, and he also got their school records. He compared the kids with lead in their teeth to those who hadn't been poisoned. In 1979, he published his findings.
What he found is that if a kid had elevated lead levels, even if it wasn't causing what were traditionally the symptoms of chronic lead poisoning, you found that teachers said that these kids had problems at school, they had trouble learning, they couldn't read as quickly.
A more recent set of studies looked at crime rates over the past few decades. The researchers found drops in crime. They correlated to the time when a location outlawed lead and gasoline. The logic is that fewer people impaired by lead poisoning means fewer people at risk for getting into trouble. Rosser's not a big fan of that line of thinking.
Crime is such a complicated issue, and who gets arrested is so socially determined. To say lead causes a child to be a criminal is kind of missing the point about the injustice of the criminal justice system.
But he says other researchers have found lead poisoning correlates to lower IQ, aggression, impulse control issues. And here's why I said the situation's so sinister. These days, lead poisoning typically happens in run-down older homes, often rentals where landlords fail to repaint. Kids living in these places are already at a socioeconomic disadvantage. Add lead poisoning to the mix, it can set them back even further. But lead poisoning can affect anyone. Back in 2007, Heather Fameen and her family moved into a two-story row home of their own. She says she knew going in the house had lead paint, but she figured she'd clean regularly, she'd make sure it didn't flake. The kids would be okay.
But one day, we saw my daughter Stella, who was almost two at the time, and I caught her chewing on the banister. And then I noticed there was at least a dozen more bite marks all up the banister.
She took Stella to the doctor. The little girl had just enough lead in her blood so the authorities had to be notified. Inspectors came, and Fameen spent the next year stripping old paint from the house.
My name is Stella.
Stella's now a healthy 8-year-old. She likes Pokemon and playing dress-up with her little sister. And much to her mom's relief, she's one of the top students in her class. But for a lot of Philadelphia children, lead poisoning has more serious consequences.
Lead poisoning is still a problem in Philadelphia, absolutely.
That's Rachel Greenberg. She heads the Southeastern Pennsylvania Lead and Healthy Homes Program through the National Nursing Centers Consortium. She says over 85% of Philadelphia's housing stock was built before 1978, before lead paint was illegal. That's more older housing than in most big cities.
Also, we have a very high percentage of children under 6. So when you combine those two factors, I do feel like the issue of lead poisoning is being overlooked in Philadelphia.
In 2012 alone, nearly 1,000 Philadelphia kids had lead poisoning. Pennsylvania leads the country as far as the percentage of kids with lead in their blood. Greenberg says, yeah, overall lead poisoning is less common than it used to be.
However, the number of children being tested is also being decreased as well.
She says that when it comes to services for preventing lead poisoning, Philly's worse off than it used to be. And other health advocates in the city point out the new lead law doesn't do enough. It only requires landlords to get lead inspections on properties they rent to families with kids 6 and under, which could lead landlords to just avoid renting to these young families. And the law does nothing to protect renters with 7 or 8-year-old kids. This year brought a big victory for the fight against lead poisoning. 6 major California cities sued a group of lead paint companies. The city said the companies knew all along lead paint was dangerous. Now they should be responsible for getting rid of it. The suit succeeded. The lead companies have to pay $1.1 billion towards getting lead off California walls. Lead historian David Rosner testified in the case.
Here you have California, which is kind of the bellwether state for all sorts of environmental laws in general. The bellwether state saying that this issue could be addressed through the courts, and that these large, large population centers have a right to gain compensation from these companies.
He's hoping other large cities like Philadelphia will follow suit. Back in the Philly row home, Aladdin Raffi's finishing up his inspection.
So we have here the back bedroom windowsill, so I'm going to put it in that particular tube.
The samples all get sent off to a lab.
We're pretty much done.
So easy.
Yeah, it is. That's a very pleasant, actually.
Raffi got the apartment's test back from the lab the following week. The results? Lead-free. For The Pulse, I'm Audrey Quinn.
Okay, on to something completely different in true Pulse fashion. This comedian.
Because my background actually did come into comedy in a little bit of an unusual fashion. I finished my PhD in ecology and evolution at UC Davis, and then I went into comedy, which I do not recommend. It's like spending 6 years of your life training for the Olympics and then going, you know what, I think I'd rather be a glassblower.
Tim Lee did get a PhD in ecology and evolution from UC Davis and then decided that's not what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. He'd always had an interest in comedy, so...
So I wrote down some jokes, and I showed up at a laundromat that had an open mic and did my first stand-up comedy routine.
What were the jokes about?
I remember the first thing I said that got a laugh, which wasn't meant to be a joke, which was the MC introduced me and he said... Okay, this next guy is his first time on stage, so I want you to, give him a lot of love when he comes on up here. Please welcome Tim Lee. And I said, I got up there. I'm like, he's right. You know, this is my first time on stage, but don't worry, I've read a lot of books. Because I'd read a lot of books to prepare for my open mic. Coming from an academic background,
right.
That's what I thought you would do. And everyone laughs. And I'm like, I don't know why they're laughing, but... I guess it's funny.
Did they laugh at your jokes?
Some of them they laughed at. Some of them were very obscure. But I think about a third of them got laughs.
Did you pick comedy because you thought you had an inkling that you might be funny or not?
I thought I could be funny, but I did a very academic approach to it. I mean, I read a bunch of books by comics first. And then they were all talking about, you know, the difficulty of writing a joke, that it seems very easy, but it's actually quite difficult. And turns out that... You know, it is a very difficult pursuit, but if you have to approach it both from like a creative perspective and a little bit from the scientific perspective, in that I record every set and I remove all the stuff that's not working, or I try to improve the stuff that's not working.
What makes it so difficult?
What makes it so difficult is because everybody finds something different funny. You know, it's things that are funny to me. I always write jokes that are funny to me, but that doesn't mean they're going to be funny to anyone else. And in fact, a lot of the jokes I record into my phone when I think of them, and then I listen to them myself a week later, and they're not funny to me even. So it's finding that common ground where that it's funny to me and other people, and then we can all agree at the same time and laugh.
How does science figure into your routine?
It figures into it a lot because it's a reflection of the way I think, and I guess I do PowerPoint bits in this show I'm doing, Scientist Turned Comedian. I do that because originally when I was giving serious talks, I liked it when people did gag slides, you know, and so when I gave a talk, I tried to throw in some gag slides into my...
When you were still a scientist.
Yes, into my regular talk. I really enjoyed that. Now, I found that about 50% of the people at the talk found it like vaguely disturbing, I think it was was the
different
quote.
Different audience.
Yeah. Vaguely disturbing, and about 50% really liked it, but I really liked it. So when I started doing comedy, one night I was at a bar in Palo Alto, and they had a screen and a projector, and I'm like, oh, why don't I try those old bits that I used to do? And I tried it at a bar, and the people loved it. I'm like, well, if they like it at this bar, they'll probably do very well at comedy clubs. I tried a comedy club, worked well too. So then I started doing basically explanations of scientific phenomena and jokes about it.
But PowerPoints are usually... so boring. Is that
yes.
Another part that makes it funny, that you use them?
Yeah, I guess so, because I hated all the PowerPoints that I used to watch. It was like they'd put no effort into making it even the slightest bit interesting. And so I liked the idea of parodying that. And it's basically what most of my act is, a parody of a scientific seminar. And
it seems like being a scientist has really helped you sharpen your skills and develop new skills.
I think so. I mean, it's a way of thinking. It's got some drawbacks in that you don't develop social skills. You're very isolated in your own thoughts. And that I had to learn because it's not enough to come across the truth. You have to be able to put the truth in someone else's mind. And if you can't do that, it's almost pointless to come up with the truth, right? Because other people have to accept it as well for it to make any difference. So that's one of the sad parts about academia and science, is that they really never teach you the proper way to communicate your results and what you found and how to put it in a form that other people can understand so they can act on it in some way. So that's why I've learned a lot of that through comedy.
Does it feel, I guess when you're a scientist, you can think that you're working on something that is good for humanity, that's yeah. important.
Yeah.
Does comedy feel that way?
Well, you know, that's been a big internal debate. It's not the most important thing you can do, and I know that. But people do come to the show kind of depressed, and they leave happy, and that is at least worthwhile.
What kind of people come to see your show? Is it like the kind of nerd fab
audience? Just rock and rollers. It's just rock and rollers. It is, yeah, I mean, it's nerdy people. I don't think there's anything wrong with being a nerd. You can look however. It's just you have a respect for academic pursuits, you know, and I think that's something very worthwhile.
Tim Lee is a stand-up comedian living in California. His show is called Scientist Turned Comedian.
Yeah, on the radio, the oil companies are giving out gas-saving advice that they know you're not going to use. Chevron has a commercial. Did you know if you drove 55 instead of 65 on the freeway, you could get an extra 30 to 60 miles to the tank? Which is true, because you would actually get pushed forward by the honking noise.
Finding a job is a major challenge for a lot of people with disabilities, especially in a tight job market. A Philadelphia program tries to equip special needs high school students with job skills to give them a leg up on the competition. It's a collaboration between Einstein Medical Center and Philadelphia schools that has lasted 40 years. Jeanette Woods took a tour of the program.
Down a maze of corridors, in a corner of the Volunteer Services Department, is the tiny office where Mark Spiller heads the training program.
This is my cozy little spot.
This year, he's working with 18 special needs high school students from four different area schools.
The way the program begins every day is they come in here and they punch in on this time clock to simulate a real job experience. Then at 8 o'clock, I'll walk out into the lobby and I'll say it's about that time.
The juniors and seniors spend 3 hours volunteering at Einstein, working alongside of and being mentored by hospital staff before returning to their classrooms.
The majority of our students are classified as having learning disabilities, learning difficulties.
In 1973, Spiller started his career as a special education teacher at Olney High School. It didn't take him long to realize his students needed more than he could give them in the classroom.
This may be heresy in some circles, but not everybody is going to college. These students needed some sort of vocational experience other than the academics.
In 1975, he helped create a collaboration between the medical center and the school district of Philadelphia. Student volunteers get to try out four different job training stations.
We do a little bit of everything from storage and delivery of supplies to patient transport, patient aid, clerical services, you name it, we do it.
I think that any type of job training prior to graduation for a student that wants to work when they graduate is invaluable.
Maggie Haig is director of the Adult Transition Programs at Devereux, an organization that provides services for adults with intellectual disabilities and autism. She recommends that schools start providing students with job skills as early as age 14.
The way we look at it is you can't really begin practicing those skills early enough.
Even though the students are volunteers, Mark Spiller instills a strong work ethic. We make the rounds, checking on his students.
She's right here.
Okay.
I got her.
Guadalupe Suarez is at work on a stack of patient folders in the prenatal testing unit.
I'm a volunteer here at Einstein Medical Center. I file the patient charts in alphabetical order, and I pull out the ones for the next day, and I pull out the ones that need to be taken to medical records.
Suarez has been through the entire vocational lineup.
I like all of my training stations so much that it's like I can't decide which one I like the best.
Okay.
Do a great job.
Students like Suarez can leave the program with an edge in the competitive market for hospital service workers at one of the region's hundreds of medical facilities, and maybe even at Einstein.
Okay, we're going to head down the stairs.
As we finish up the tour, Spiller runs into a former student.
This is Rhonda. Come on over here. This is Rhonda Haynes,
Hello.
Class of 1983.
distinguished alumnus.
It's been so such a long time. I graduated in 1984, love the program. I am a hostess, so I take care of the psych floor and the oncology floor. As long as I'm pleasing my patients and they, you know, let me know that I'm doing a good job, and that's what I like, the patients, y'all.
Since 1975, the program has seen about 600 students. Spiller is especially proud of the students that end up at Einstein, about 50, including Rhonda Haynes.
To me, the full circle of success is when former students who were student volunteers became employees, now become mentors of the new crop of student volunteers that come in. And that's, you know, that's just incredible.
For The Pulse, I'm Jeanette Woods. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joe Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.